1, 2, 3, 4, Medium Talk.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Medium Talk with Rod on the Blackout Tips Premium Network. It's been a couple weeks since I put one of these out, man. I'm always trying to get great guests to talk to interesting people, and today is no exception. If you've listened to Righteous Prick podcast, which I assume a lot of you guys listen to, it also has our friend Chris Lambert on there all the time, and we're always telling you guys to go listen to him. Or if you've listened to a couple of our spoiled movie reviews, it's the homie JL Covan. What's going on, JL?
How are you? Thanks for having me.
Oh, no problem, man. I'm glad that I was able to get on with you and get a good time set up where we could talk. Can you tell the people how to get in contact with you and where to find all your stuff?
Sure. My website is jlcovan.com. That's J-L-C-A-U-V-I-N. And that has everything. You know, that has links to my weekly podcast, my weekly movie reviews, and coming out in it's supposed to come out September 24th, but it'll actually be out sooner, I think. My new album, Keep My Enemies Closer, stand-up album, will be out soon. And you can, you know, all the information for that will be on the website. So if you go to my website, you can find everything. The Twitter, you know, Twitter is JL Covan, same spelling. So,
all that's right.
Thanks for the upfront plug.
No problem, man. You know, always got to give it an opportunity, man. A lot of times, we'll get comedians on and they'll either not plug or forget to plug or get almost like embarrassed to plug. You know, it's like, right. It's like, hey man, this is how you make the money, dude. You got to get out there, sound confident, sell them.
I know I'm too desperate in this game now to have any, you know, it's like, ain't too proud to beg. Like I'll plug as many times as I can.
Speaking of, being in the game, how long have you been doing stand up?
This past June was 10 years, so a little over 10 years.
And how did you first get into it? What was the impetus to, you know, get on that stage for the first time?
Sure. Well, I was always a big comedy fan, but and I was always kind of a funny guy, you know, doing impressions and stuff. But I never thought of doing stand-up. I just liked watching it. And in my second year of law school in D.C., a guy in my building where I lived was putting up flyers for like a local comedy show at a bar that was in my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And I was so bored and kind of depressed in law school that I was like, yeah, I could use a night off and just go see, you know, some free entertainment. Worst case scenario, it's free and it sucks. Best case, it's free and it's good. And I went with a buddy to a bar near my apartment and I saw just a bunch of kind of local guys, one of whom is actually doing his thing in LA, but you know, it was a bunch of people just who liked comedy and had been doing it for a couple of years. And the show was a lot of fun. And it just kind of opened my eyes that it made it seem a little more accessible. Mm-hmm. So I thought, hey, I might want maybe this summer when I'm done with the school year, it was my second year of law school. So I was like, I think I'll try doing some open mics this summer. And I did, and then I haven't stopped since.
So while you were in school, does that mean you were also doing stand up in law school?
Just my third year. So I started the summer after my second year because my job was in DC that summer. Mm-hmm. So I just was going to a lot of the open mics that summer and then throughout the school year of my third year. Cause I had gotten a job, I guess, relatively early into third year. Mm-hmm. So the pressure was sort of off and I just started getting into, you know, that just became my big hobby. And it wasn't hard to get people to come out and watch shows, even though I wasn't very good relative to how I am now. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I had a bunch of law student friends who were about to sign their lives away to law firms and government offices. So any excuse for them to come out and see something out of the ordinary was kind of fun.
So you were pretty open, I guess, about the fact that you were doing stand-up. I know a lot of comedians, like when they first start out, it's either like a lot of times nobody will come see them, but either it's kind of like, well, I got this other stuff, you know, because I think a lot of people have hobbies and, you know, maybe whether it's a podcast, whether it's stand-up, whether it's a lot of stuff, you know, acting, whatever, where you're kind of like, I don't know if I want to mix this with my day job, with my daytime, you know, JL Covan. from the jump, were you always like, I want people to know and, you know, to see me, whether it's in law school or at a job, to understand that I also do stand up?
Well, I think it was really a hobby, just a hobby I was very dedicated to. But of course, the thing is, if you're familiar with what bringer shows are, mm-hmm. Basically, when I started trying to get spots at clubs, you know, when you're a new comic, they basically make you bring people. And so then I had to get my friends and at a certain point coworkers involved. And the thing is, it's a novelty. And my friends and coworkers knew me to be funny. They didn't know me necessarily to be a comedian. So I guess it was, if you've made an impression on people as a funny person, they're more inclined to want to see you be funny. And so, yeah, I remember when I got on TV while still working at the Bronx DA's office, then the cat was out of the bag. Cause I remember my next job, which was at a law firm, they didn't know I did comedy. I intentionally left it off the resume because you don't want to make people, you don't want to give a reason to people to kind of question you.
Right.
But so I got the job offer. I did the spot on Ferguson like 3 weeks before I got the job offer. But then when I showed up for the job in January, I had a meeting with one of the partners who hired me, which was like, we didn't know about the comedy when we offered. Like they tried to not sound angry about it. Because, but of course, it was a TV set and there was nothing about the law and it was very clean and safe stuff. So there was no reason for them to sort of go, I don't think we can trust this guy. To all impressions to them were that I was just had this kind of clean comedy side habit that I just happened to be moderately successful at. Mm. But yeah, now I've probably got 45 minutes of law material that's on the internet or that I've done. So if I ever have to get back into a legal job now, I think there's going to be some difficulty.
Well, you know what's funny to me? Isn't it amazing how little research people will do, though? Because if I found out a guy was being a comedian or something on the side and it was my company, I would probably check out as much material as I could, you know, to be like, okay, you know. And I'm not even saying like to be like, I'm gonna fire this dude, but just so you can go, this is what this guy does. Am I comfortable with that? And if it ever comes up, you know, I can see what's going on and also see how good he is at it. See, you know, how, cause you can kind of sell like, oh, this guy is probably gonna be able to do this professionally at some point. You know, this might be a thing where he doesn't want to spend extra hours in the office or he's got a big, gig or something. He's going out of town and he's not going to be able to put in overtime on a weekend. It seems like very, I don't know, rudimentary to me that people would just check on stuff like that. And it often does not get checked on.
You raise excellent points. But I think if there's one benefit, I can say is that the last time I applied for a job was 2007. So Twitter was not a thing. YouTube was really just emerging as a mainstream thing. And so I think now people probably just do, even a basic Google search will reveal plenty if you spend an hour on Google. Mm. But I think back then it wasn't really in people's minds that there was all this wealth of social media information that people were putting out themselves. Now I think people would probably just do at least a basic in their basic run-up would probably discover all sorts of off-color jokes on my Twitter account, etc.
Did you ever have a time where you considered like an alias or something like that?
Well, a friend of mine brought up the fact that if and when I start applying for regular jobs, I should revert to my full name again, Jean-Louis.
Ah.
And even though that's not an alias, you know, I'll just insist that everybody call me Jean-Louis for the first month at work until I go, oh, you know, you can call me JL. And then they do a JL search. And I'm like, this guy is a horrible human being.
And, you know, and the thing is, it does, like, if you put Jean-Louis or whatever, even if JL Covan comes up, it does give them enough pause where they're like, that's probably not him.
Right.
You know, like he wouldn't say
it. So boring in the interview.
Right. That was my thing when I had a jobby job was, the masquerade, at work was probably the most difficult part, because I would just go to work and completely try to shut myself off. Like, as, and by shut myself off, I just mean like I'm not making any jokes. I'm not, no crude humor. No, I just keep it completely separate. You know, I'm laughing at like my boss's lame jokes and, you know, coworkers coming in and telling me what the cute thing that Pat did. I'm like, oh, that's the greatest thing ever. But then I'm going home and I'm like, oh man, these fucking people with their pets at work and all this shit. So, you know, it was always good that, they never did try to Google me or find out what I was up to. Cause I feel like, it would have definitely been issues. When you were doing your stand up at the time, the people who, for the Bringer shows and stuff, were those people that you were bringing ever the subject of your stand up? And did they ever feel any kind of way about it?
Only, you know, over the course of it, only girlfriends. I never did work material while I was working at a place. I remember even on my second CD, there were a lot of people from my law firm at the taping, you know, cause I was at the firm almost a year and, you know, we were all friendly and it was a one time kind of big Saturday night show. And I even just mentioned that I worked at sort of a white shoe kind of high, you know, corporate type law firm, and you just hear like six or seven chuckles in the audience, and that's not even a joke. That's just me mentioning that I work at a firm, and they were already like giggling. So I can imagine if they heard. So I mean, I've had friends who no longer work at the firm hear some of my stuff about working at the firm now, and you know, it gets big laughs from everybody, but especially the people I worked with, because they do know what I'm talking about. But I, you know, I would never joke about somebody that's paying me.
Yeah, exactly.
Unless I got so big that I was like, you know, joking about NBC or Fox. But if I'm just joking about the people that give me health insurance, no.
That's also funny too, that, cause so many comedians do that, where it's like, my relationship though is completely fair game. You know, like, you're dating me, whatever happens that I can turn into material might come up on stage. Which is funny, because, you know, a job is a certain type of commitment, but a relationship has the potential to be like a lifelong commitment. So it's, you know, it's like, I'll risk that for the material, but, not this job.
What I was going to say is actually, any language restrictions on this?
Oh, fuck no. You can curse.
Okay, there we go. And it was at a bar show that me and two friends ran in Hoboken, New Jersey for a few years. Very fun show, but very intimate. You know, it was the kind of show where we drew about 20, 25 people each week, but the room made it feel full.
Mm.
So my girlfriend at the time, who became my fiance, who became my ex-fiance, I had run several jokes by her about her, and each one individually had kind of gotten, oh, that's funny, that's okay. But then I did all of them together in a set, which amounted to like 6 of my 10 minutes. And I threw one extra joke in that she had not heard before, which was, at the time, I think it was MySpace. They had these things. I forget what they, like, quizzes. MySpace had quizzes that people would take, and they were stupid, but they, you know, they were kind of the equivalent of like Farmville now on Facebook.
Yeah.
And I said, anybody take those quizzes on MySpace? They're so annoying, but I'm wondering if there's a quiz that will tell you how many of your girlfriend's MySpace friends has she fucked? And because I knew for a fact she was like still MySpace friends with like multiple ex-boyfriends, which I just found stupid.
Right.
But that one was the one that I think put her over the top. And my friends to this day that were at that show have such respect, because she was sitting right there with like 12 other people. So it was just completely naked. And I just went for my own girlfriend's jugular, you know, and this was not in like a theater where there were 500 people.
Right.
And I think that was a stepping stone in me becoming a more open comic, because you can't get more ballsy than that.
Now, was that the thing that was the beginning of the end? Was it like, yeah, this is not going to work for me?
She was looking for numerous beginnings of the ends. She is to this day, I put her somewhere between Hitler and Ariel Castro on list of worst human beings to ever draw breath on Earth.
But how did you end up getting engaged? Because that's pretty serious, man. How did she slip past all that?
It's one of those things where, to be honest, I was in the best shape of my life, making the most money I'd ever made in my life, and I'd just gotten a late night television spot. So comedically, physically, economically, I was just at the peak of my life. And, you know, I'm one of these people, I guess, that requires some kind of struggle or conflict. Mm. So I sort of, and I come from, my parents have kind of a very, let's just say, a hostile marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, even though I knew that I didn't think that it was not the greatest love I'd ever felt, but for some reason it felt very comfortable to be in sort of with an attractive chick that makes you laugh, but also every week you have a major fight or conflict over something. And she was a very harsh, insulting, sort of alternated between sweet and incredibly cruel human being.
Mm.
But for whatever reason, I didn't like it, but something in my subconscious, I think, made me very comfortable with it. Like it was how it should be. And to this day, I still look at it and go, you know, I had a friend, and maybe I just scare my friends too much, but I had a friend actually call my mother and tell her, you know, I don't want to get in his face, because you never want to be the friend that tells your friend this bitch needs to go.
Yeah.
Because then you might be the one to go. But he said to my mom, he's like, I think you may be the only one that can talk some sense in him, but I do not think he should do this.
Mm.
And I never broke it off. She broke it off like 3 times. Before it finally took. But, you know, this is, I don't want to get the tone of this too dark, but
right.
she's a horrible, horrible person.
So, but like, okay, so did you feel she was horrible the first time she tried to break it off?
Well, I think I was I don't want to say devastated, but very hurt.
Right.
So I was not in a position to sort of go in, you know, it was only on like the third time where I finally was like, you know, called her a cunt.
Yeah.
And told her, you know, you're cruel to men because your father doesn't love you. And we both know that he's a cold dude and you've been making men pay for it. And she said, oh, then why are all my ex-boyfriends friends with me if I'm such a bad person? I said, because you need them to be in your life so you can feel like you're finally controlling men since you never could find a way to emotionally connect to your father. And I said my, and this was like yelling and like yeah. at her, and it cut her. I could tell it was like when Drago got cut in Rocky IV.
Yeah.
It was like that moment where I was like, oh my God, he landed a punch.
Yeah. The truth is always way more hurtful than just an insult in any way. Yeah. I like we had a, some people that we had some issues with our show, and they were like really going in on a friend of ours and like saying a bunch of underhanded fucked up shit, lying about them and stuff. And I talked about the group on the show, and there's like, I don't know, maybe 15, 20 of these people, all races, creed, colors, sizes, all this shit. And I just called them collectively a group of cunts. And and then they had this like this thread on Google Plus where they were like saying all this shit, and I just read it word for word, like, this is the fucked up things that you guys do and say, and added my commentary. And that was like over a year ago, and I just got hit up like yesterday by them still being mad. And I was like, yes, you know, like that is exactly what I wanted. Someone was like, well, how could you say something so insulting? I said, because I wanted them to be insulted. Like, it's only helping me to know that it did cut deep. Like, it felt good to be like, it, yes, you're still hurt by something I said that I meant to hurt. The worst thing you could have done is been like, I'm moving on with my life. This doesn't bother me at all.
Right.
Well, that's awesome.
Yeah, with me and her, and what the thing I really regret now, since I'm just kind of hustling and trying to make it in comedy, is that I was with somebody, the only person I've ever dated who wasn't supportive and cool about my comedy, just happened to be the person I was dating when I had my break, like when I had my shot. And I think she was threatened by it, even though I wanted to share it with her. I think she was threatened by it because her dreams hadn't come true. and there was a little bit of jealousy. Like, you know, she was one of these chicks who was always used to being the star in a relationship, whereas me, I like to be in kind of an, not to sound all modern and pussy whipped, right, but in like a partnership. You know, people yeah. bring strengths, but I don't need to be. I've always said this to people about her. I think what she wanted a dude that was a car, and she wanted to be the Mercedes symbol in the front of the car.
Mm, okay.
That's her kind of mind. You know, almost every dude she dated was kind of like mediocre looking and like a plain white dude. And it was like, oh, of course, they're going to show you off like you're the greatest thing they've ever seen.
Kind of like that trophy thing.
I think she wanted to be a trophy wife, but not a trophy wife, so she could have some sort of moral high ground on trophy wives.
Right.
She's a piece of shit. She's a piece of shit, and we can move on. But yeah, that's the unfortunate thing was, of every woman I've ever dated seriously, this was the worst possible one who could have been with me when I was kind of on the move. And now I'm trying to make, you know, trying to have a second surge and hope that some of the stuff I've done now can give me a second shot.
Well, let's talk about that. First, when did you go full-time stand-up? Like, what was the impetus for you to go, no more day job, no more distractions, I'm going to go full-time?
Well, I said to myself, when I got the engagement ring back, a.k.a. took it, oh no, because she's the kind of spiteful person who would have like tried to hold out or negotiate.
Oh, those are the worst type of human beings.
In the middle of the fight, I said, "Well, you won't be needing this anymore," and just grabbed it off the dresser. And fortunately, I got full value back for it, which was quite a substantial full value. And I said to myself, "Okay, I've got a pretty big savings nest. I want to do comedy. I'm free. I'm no longer shackled to any person. I'm going to quit the law when I turn 30, which would have been April 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to try and just go get on the road and do everything I can to quote unquote make it. And then I got laid off in February of 2009. So I said, I went back into my diary and erased April 2009 and wrote February 2009 and said, when history discovers this journal, they won't think that I got laid off. So yeah, that's basically what it was. So the timing was close enough, and my, you know, my family kind of supported me because they saw that I had some buzz and that I'd gotten on TV, and they took that as kind of a sign, like maybe we should, you know, it wasn't up to them whether I go for it or not, but they were, you know, whether they support it or not, and they were supportive for it, and I'm sure now they regret that, understandably.
so you think they see you as not having achieved enough with stand-up at this point?
Yes, and I sort of see that as well. They, because what they look at it as, they have a son who went to very good schools, you know, worked for the government, got hired by a private firm. So I have more earning potential, and they're not about like me being rich or anything like that, but they just, over the years, they've seen me sort of go to war with stand-up comedy and kind of struggle a little bit, which they're not used to seeing. And they know that I have the means to sort of at least be comfortable, if not successful.
Yeah.
You know, but at the same time, they also do believe in my talent. So it's very hard for them to just say quit or no. But I think we're probably, me and my family are probably in the same mental state where it's like, I got to make something happen soon or really get some potential going, or else I just, you know, part of me just wants to start living a normal life. If I can't get the life I want, obviously the greatest life would be making money to, you know, making good money as a stand-up comic.
Yeah.
But if that can't happen, I'm getting to the point where it's just like, you know, I've spent from age 24 to 34 plus as a comic. And now I know I can't give up age 34 to 44 in the same predicament.
Yeah. You know? And you were on your show. I heard you talking about like possibly, you know, walking away from stand up within like, you know, a matter of months even.
Yeah.
So,
planning, or at least, you know what I mean? Yeah. At least start planning to move away from it.
Yeah, what would that look like? You just start looking at those wanted ads, or is it gonna be just cold turkey? Is it, you know, would you like kind of do it on the side for a while? Like, how do you think it would be to, you know, walk away from something that, you know, it seems that, not even seems, you must love to sacrifice this much for?
Well, I just, to me, it used to be love.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like now it feels more like a mission, and I don't like quitting, and I don't like, and believe me, when I write a new joke, it feels great. And when it works, it feels great. When I'm on the road, it feels great. And when I'm getting praise for certain things, it feels great. But that great high used to last me days. Now it lasts me minutes because I'm faced with reality of not being as successful as I want to be. You know, I haven't, this is just one like lame, sad example, but like, you know, I haven't bought my nephews. The last gift I bought one of my nephews was probably a year and a half, 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be like taking Amtrak down to DC to see them and be like, guess what? I'm your present.
I'm here.
That Amtrak is not cheap to DC, kids. and that's, you know, that's no big deal. But it's not what I want to do. It's not how I want to live my life. Like, there are more important things. You know, my parents are getting older. And it's one of those things where you just start to say, I want this very badly. But I also don't want to become a super selfish person or a more selfish person than I am. And there are other things that are important.
Yeah.
That I'm not as comfortable passing up or missing out on. And, you know, I've had some good things happen this year, but in terms of money, you know, respect doesn't pay rent and pay cable bills.
Yeah.
So it's what I, you know, I don't know that I could ease my way out. I think I'm going to go until, you know, I'm going to treat it like a race where I run until I can't run anymore. And then I'm just going to walk off the track because I'm the type of personality where I don't want to hang out at open mics and hear about all the successes either younger dudes are having or my peers are finally getting.
Yeah.
Because it'll start to creep into me and go, ooh, maybe I shouldn't have quit. Now I can either regret quitting or I can like start to creep back in and see. And then before you know it, you've spent another 6-7 years of your nights not spending it with family, not spending it with friends, but working towards something that still may not happen.
Yeah. Now, a lot of the material that you do, like, I saw the CK impression, video, which I thought was brilliant. It was very funny. The YouTube comments were very divided. Some people were very upset that you would dare imitate the great Louis CK. I also love that there's two comments that are the top comments, and one of them is just like some fag trying to do his little impression or something, and then right. the other is like this kind of thoughtful, like, you know, I'm a big Louis C.K. fan, but I can understand, you know, that he, you know, that this is funny and there's can be satire found in mocking his average sense of humor, blah blah blah. And I was like, that's YouTube for you. Like, that is exactly YouTube. It's just nigger and then someone writing an essay, like but I thought it was great. But I wonder, like, you know, when you do stuff like that, you know, when you're on your Facebook page or your podcast and you're talking about other comedians and their stand-up, who you like and who you don't like, a lot of comedians don't do that. Like, they will absolutely bullshit you. And it's like, I know you don't like Dane Cook per se, right? I know that there's no, I listen to your stand up. I listen to the general comments people say about other guys and stuff like that. And you go, I know this person I'm talking to doesn't like Dane Cook. But if you go, yeah, well, you know, I was watching Dane Cook's show and it's so fucking lame. It's like, well, you know, Dane Cook puts in a lot of work. He's a good guy. I understand that he likes to, you know, talk to his friends. And you're like, damn, dude, like, why wouldn't you just say how you feel? And I wonder if you kind of telling it like it is, quote unquote, or not really pulling punches when it comes to just talking about comedy in general, do you feel like that is limiting? Like, people are like, I don't know if I'm gonna work with JL. I fuck around being one of his skits as, you know, in the scare straight thing, and I'm that's fucking me, you know, like, I don't, now I'm not putting him on my show.
Yeah, you know what? I got to that point. This year has been a I don't want to say transformational, but I kind of, you know, this business has put me into a place of desperation. But instead of being desperate about it, I just said, well, now I'll just be completely honest. And it's yielded me a lot of praise and a lot of respect. And to me, it's like, what am I going to do? Burn bridges that weren't there for me?
Right. Yes.
Like, you didn't offer me a bridge. You didn't offer me opportunity. So now I'll get my name out there by telling all of you to fuck off, because you are fake. You are. This is some profession that's all about, you know, they get upset when some chick blogger writes something and they feel under attack. And then they're like, how can you challenge our honesty? This is a free art. This is. And then somebody just kind of metaphorically punches them in the face and they go away and cry and say he can't come in.
Mm.
The vision I had of comedy was what people talk about comedy like it's raw. And I'm not even talking about language, but it's a place of honesty and it's a place of truth.
Right.
And yet it's not. And that's what's bothered me the most, is that it's become a place where everything is funny, because a lot of alternative rooms sprung up so that people, instead of trying to work within the rules, so to speak, I'll just find some people who find my shit funny. And because of the internet and all that stuff, everybody can find their own audience. But I want to be big.
Right.
And I don't mean big in terms of wealth, although that could come. Mm-hmm. But I want to be what comedy's supposed to be. You know? And it's one of those things, like, everybody loves Patrice and everybody loves Bill Burr, and they're on top of the game. Or that, you know, Patrice obviously has died, but, you know, he's now being sainted by people who probably didn't even like him when he was alive.
Yeah, I find that odd, too, because I thought that Patrice O'Neill was one of the more controversial type of listens. And to me, the brilliance of him was that he could turn the most fucked up misogynistic point of view into something that got the room to go, well, I can see where he's coming from.
Yes.
And that was, to me, it was funny because I'm a fan of the awkward and that change in an audience where they go from, I know this motherfucker did, women do be, okay, all right. Yeah. Like, I like that, but I was like, that'll never be Chris Rock big, and that'll never be, you can't put that necessarily in a stadium because too many people are gonna be like, fuck this dude, you know?
Sure. And not everybody has to be that confrontational.
Right.
And I don't get as dirty as him. I think I try to be as confrontational, but I don't try to manufacture a confrontation.
Right.
Like I said, like the last track on my new album is called Why White Women Disappear.
Mm.
And a lot of people have told me they think it's like, it's the kind of track you would almost expect to hear from Patrice, but in my language and in my sort of spirit. But it's not going to be for everybody. And I made that joke when I was working on that bit in an all-white room or an almost all-white room in Connecticut, and it fell so flat. And it's never fallen flat anywhere else, but it fell flat.
Was it Hartford, Connecticut, or no?
No, it was anywhere. It's like near Danbury, I think.
Okay.
Is that a Chappelle joke?
Yeah.
And they didn't heckle me. It was just like, it was not, I was talking about, you know, the punchline. It's about a 9-minute bit.
Right.
And at the time, it was probably only about 3 or 4 minutes. But I the end of it is basically, that's, you know, white. The gist of the joke is here. I talk about how white chicks in Manhattan are the biggest pieces of shit on earth for like 8 minutes. And then I say, and how do they get away with it? Well, you know, on Fox News, where every 2 years there's a story about how a white chick goes to the Bahamas and doesn't come back. That's why.
Mm.
You know, almost like a virgin ritual sacrifice. And it kills in a lot of places, but it was almost as if I was in a town where some chick had disappeared. That was the response was so silent and uncomfortable. But to me, that just affirms, and I don't go out trying to fucking ruin people's nights. Like, if you don't laugh at this, you just don't get it.
Right.
You know, some people don't have to like everything I do.
Right.
And they shouldn't. But there's some jokes I tell that everybody likes, and there's some that people don't like. But the whole comedy scene to me, it's just become very obvious. And I think if you saw the Scared Straight video is another one where I really kind of.
Yeah, yeah. I loved it, but I, like, when I watch it, I also get this, like, does JL just not want to make it? Like, does he just, like, it's like coming to the beach and kicking down everyone's sandcastle a little bit, where it's like, maybe he doesn't want to play with the other kids. I don't know.
But to me, that's the other thing. See, and I treat comedy like it's like a solo sport, like I'm a tennis player, not like I'm on a fucking hockey team or a basketball team or a football team. To me, it's, I'm a tennis player. I'm taking the shots and I'm delivering the shots. But I remember, like, people will post things from famous comedians not realizing they don't live by those. Like, Chris Rock had a thing where he said, this was a couple years ago, what the fuck is with all the comedians, like, acting like chicks? Like, hey, we're going to the club tonight. We're all going to the club. Like, comedy is an individual thing. You got to be inside your own head. Right. And I've spent a lot of time by myself in the last several years. And it has made me stronger as a comic and maybe unhappier as a person. But it's really given me a lot of strength and insight as a comic because I'm always thinking things over. But there is, and everybody was like talking about Chris Rock. Oh, Chris Rock, oh, that's awesome that he said that. But it's like, next thing you know, you're hanging out with your clique
right.
at your open mic. And it seems that's the way to success. And I thought that was just the corporate world. I thought the beauty of comedy was you get to be your own island. That doesn't mean be a dick to people.
Right.
That doesn't mean be rude. But as far as what I say on stage or what I produce in my sketches, which is supposed to be kind of art, you know, I hate to use that word, but you know what I mean. Like, that's.
Well, I don't think you should even hate to use that word. I think half of the problem with comedy right now is that people don't respect it as an art, and it fucking is. And if people did, you wouldn't have douchebag hecklers at shows, and you wouldn't have you know, comedians like just ripping off motherfuckers' bits and putting it on YouTube. If people actually respected it as an art, I think it, you know, it would solve a lot of the problems.
Yeah, it's just unfortunate, but I. Every time I read, and my mentality, I think, is of an old school comic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I remember Patrice telling me about him and Bill Burr, and he was just like, he seemed to have some contempt for younger comics, Patrice, because I remember he referred to him and Bill Burr as soldiers, meaning they just kept doing sets and kept trucking out to places and performing anywhere and everywhere all the time and not giving a shit, just working on their thing. And now, it just seems like everybody's trying to find their market or their clique or to work. And it's just like, I thought this was, and when you read what Chris Rock said, and I forget where this was, but it hit me so hard because I was like, that's how I view it.
Mm.
And maybe that's an outdated model. Maybe that mindset is outdated, but you will see all these people talk about how they love Patrice and like Chris Rock says all these right things and blah, blah, blah. But they don't live by that.
Right.
As comics, I don't mean they have to live like that as human beings, but as comedians, they love to hear the famous people tell the tough stories and what it takes. But then that's not what it takes now.
Right.
And that's not what people want to do. So I'm just, I think if I don't make it, I don't make it. But if I do make it, I think I'm going to benefit from sort of having some balls because I'm doing this. I put out what I put out and I say what I say as somebody who has not made it.
Right.
Now, if I had a big platform and was a superstar and was worth, you know, millions of dollars, it'd be a very safe place to operate from because I'd have value. But to me, I want my comedy to have value. I want my honesty and what the work I do to have value, not for me, the person, to have value, but like for me, the comedian, to have comedic value. And if that means I'm just the one saying everything people think and are afraid to say, so be it. Although I hate being that kind of a cliche. You know, I feel like the dude on a reality show who's like, I'm not here to make friends. And it's like, I'm not. I can't tell you how many people at this point where I'll talk to them one-on-one, either on the road or just at a bar after a show. And they'll go, dude, you're such a cool dude, or you're not a dick, or you're not. I'm like, yeah, why did you think I'm a, why? Just because my comedy happens to be a little more honest and confrontational, does that mean I have to be a dick off stage? Like the dude who talks about unicorns and ninjas and banjos, nobody thinks that dude's a fucking space cadet off stage.
Right. Nobody expects the singing comedian with an instrument to strum his way into regular conversation.
Right. So, you know, but that tells me sometimes I think that I hit people in a real place, which even if it makes people sometimes more hostile to me, at least it tells me that, yeah, I got you with that. Whether you want to be nice about it or not, what I said affected you.
Yeah.
What you think. So.
Well, now, where did your love of movies come from?
Oh, I've been thinking about this a lot through therapy as well. Mm-hmm. But I loved movies from as a little kid, like from about the age of 9. Like I started taping the Oscars every year as a little kid and just trying to figure out who would win. And I try to see the nominees as long as I was allowed to.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of it is it's one of those things as I try to figure out subconsciously, but you know, one of my favorite times as a kid, cause like I said, my parents fought a lot and it was stressful times when I was a little kid for my family. But one of the best times was my mom would just drive to Yonkers with me, like either every Saturday or Sunday, and we'd get lunch and see one or maybe even two movies. And it was just fun and relaxing for my mom. And I wonder sometimes if that stuck with me, if it's still kind of like, not to sound weird, but like a safe place.
Right.
It's just escaping and eating some popcorn and just having fun watching, you know, either a really well done movie or a really fun movie. And I find going to the movies to be like a relaxing place. Now, I for humor's sake, I critique them.
Right.
But, you know, for me, a nice movie theater and a decent movie is one of the best places to be, either with a friend, a girl, or by myself.
Yeah, it's extremely underrated, man. Like, it's amazing how few people really go out to the movies anymore, man. I love the movie going experience, and some of the movies I think you can't even appreciate if you're watching it on your laptop or your TV or something.
Yeah.
Some of this shit just needs to be seen bigger than life. And you know, I'll talk to people about certain movies and it's like, well, I didn't like that. And I'm like, well, how'd you see it? I downloaded a torrent. It was a pretty good rip. It's like, well, you didn't even fucking really see the movie, did you? Did you ever like try to like take up acting, like take acting classes, like anything like that?
I did a year program, a Meisner program, a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And my teacher was very complimentary and said she really wanted me to stick with it and this and that. And I think what happened for me is I got very out of shape. Now, over the last couple months, I've lost like 28 pounds and I'm trying to get back into the shape I was in, you know, 5 years ago when I was very happy physically.
Finally show that cunt who's boss.
Exactly. and my whole thing is it's hard for me to go. I hate the idea of going to audition and being cast as a Brad Garrett type. Because there was a time when I got management in 2007, the year I got on Ferguson, I was cut. And everybody that I talked to at the management place, which was a very big management place, was like, we love your comedy, but we also see you as a potential like action star, like in acting. Mm. That's kind of the physical presence I had. So I don't want to go out for a part and not be who I think I can be. And right. I know, and I've delayed it. I've delayed it a lot. Like I've been saying this for 2 years, but I'm finally starting to drop the weight and stick to a diet plan and an exercise regimen. Cause I think I've probably been a little depressed over the last couple of years, just from struggling with finances and career, but I'm finally losing it. And I thought if some things can happen for me with this new album or with some of the videos I'm putting out, it'd be cool to be, you know, instead of 295 to be 245 and have people say, oh, this guy could like, he could play a Marine in a movie, or he could also be like a bully in a comedy or this and that. You know what I mean?
Right.
But I want to give myself the best shot of being me, not giving them the most kind of the best perspective of me, because I think I can be funny enough and perform at this weight and at this look, but it's not the look I would like to establish myself with. If, you know, and maybe I'm just talking bullshit because I'm nervous about trying auditioning for things, but
I think confidence is a lot of it for sure. You know, and even being on a stage, there's a certain type of confidence, but, there's no confidence like, you know, that true internal, like, my mind and my body are my weapon type confidence, you know, like, look at this motherfucker, I'm presenting this to you. And yeah, if you getting that feeling back, would definitely go a long way, especially if you're really trying to put, make this one big push, you know, this last thing. Yeah, it matters, and people will perceive you differently. People, like, I know just growing a beard since, I started doing a podcast full time has changed how people view me. And I think that's weird, but it's, but just something that fucking little could do it. I don't even want to know what, like, losing weight would do. It'd probably be crazy.
Yeah, it's, but it's, you know, I think I've shown in some of the sketches that I can be kind of a funny performer on camera. And like I said, the acting teacher thought I was good, but you know, I just want to get back. I want to get back to feeling like the old me, you know, and obviously at 34, I won't feel like the 28-year-old me.
Right.
But if I can feel closer to that, that I think that would help.
Do you write your own, the skits too, or like,
yeah, I don't, cause I like to, I'll perform in other people's sketches, but all the stuff on my YouTube channel is all me, you know, acting, kind of directing and being in them. Cause I don't know. I trust myself more than I trust most people artistically.
Well, you're kind of, and then also, like, do you, I'm assuming you probably almost think in conversation, if you know what I mean? I know I do. I don't know if everybody does it and I'm just a weirdo, but where sometimes before I even talk to someone, or sometimes, man, like situations that are never going to fucking happen, I just kind of run through, like, this would be the funniest thing to say at this point.
Sure.
You know, and after I talk to someone, like, why didn't I fucking say it? Like, when I'm editing this, I will be like, I should have made a joke about this thing, and JL said that, and that should have been a callback. But, like, so do you do that? Because I think people who write kind of have to.
Yeah, I mean, it's a weird thing, but it feels like my my brain now is always thinking in jokes. I try not to be on in terms of how I deal with people,
mm-hmm.
but my head is always kind of clicking to funny things.
Yeah.
It feels like, you know, just the way an athlete eats, thinks, sleeps, trains for their sport, like to get to that level. I feel like the level I want to be at and the level I'm kind of prepared to be at, you get to a point where you just, you do it so much in so many different forms that your brain is kind of trained to think quickly and to think humorously, to find the humor in things.
Yeah. And it feels kind of also like normal you, or, you know, I speaking for myself, like normal me is, you know, cordial and all the things that a human being should be. And then there's like the brain me, and the brain me is either always thinking something completely mean or something completely hilarious to me. Like, it's always searching for those two things, where, and I just turn it off most of the time because, you know, it's not always appropriate, but
right.
I always feel like that is how comedians must be. Now, I know we're going long. I did kind of want to talk to you about the Chappelle thing too, because this has been a huge for some reason it's been huge amongst like comedians and, you know, comedy fans and stuff. Dave Chappelle performed in Hartford, Connecticut, and was not cool with some of the heckling that he said he was receiving. Or some people say it was a lot, some people say it wasn't much, but whatever it was, he decided that he was not gonna play ball and power through his set, and he decided to, you know, do his time by kind of just sitting there waiting everything out and leaving the stage. I listened to your podcast about it with Josh Homer. I thought it was excellent. I enjoyed both perspectives on it and all the take that you guys had. You guys really like kind of completely analyzed the situation. I also you know, listened to other people. I've talked about it with people. I follow a lot of comedians and stuff like that on Facebook and Twitter and read all that stuff. I was thinking, man, as an alternate theory, because I know that you guys kind of arrived at the conclusion, like, he's not really a stadium comic. Maybe right. He should do smaller venues, which I think almost nobody would argue.
Yeah, As we said, that wasn't, even though obviously Josh is a bigger fan of Chappelle's stand-up than I am, that was not a knock on Chappelle.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Just like, you know, I don't know, the Rolling Stones and Bob Dylan can both be considered phenomenal, great artists, but that doesn't mean they should both do Giant Stadium.
Right.
Or, you know, and my whole thing is I think rap is terrible in stadiums. Mm. Or arenas, just unless you know the lyrics, it will be very hard to discern the lyrics.
Yeah, rap is best on a CD. Yeah. Because whenever it's on a CD, 14 other niggas don't hop in my car and start yelling the lyrics too. Like, it's just that dude saying what he said. But with the Chappelle thing, man, I was thinking about it because I've been thinking about it a lot, and I think I came up with why he's gonna keep doing, like, why I'm okay with him doing the stadiums and not switching to a smaller venue is if this only happens one time on this tour, then I'm okay with it.
Right.
If the shit happens again, I think I'm not. Like,
sure.
It might be a one-off and we're all hyper analyzing it because, you know, he's a big name and it's, you know, and it's a big deal. And I, like, right now I'm able to spin it in my mind to where I feel like it's a stand against what audience entitlement has become, and I say it as an audience member, not as anyone that's ever been on stage, but just even as an audience member, audiences ruin shows sometimes for me, and it's fucked up. Like, I spent my money the same way that the next guy spent his money, and that guy decides, well, since I spent $40, I get to yell out quotes from Half Baked and fucking, you know, pull out my phone and start recording shit and play some fucking Candy Crush, and it's like, the fuck are you doing? The artist is on stage doing something and I'm trying to pay attention. You know, this isn't just tweeting in a movie or whatever, which I still think is fucked up, but you're fucking up a live performance right now. And I kind of like that a lot of comedians are standing behind it because they're like, yeah, shit is getting out of control. But at the same time, I really hope that never happens again. Cause, you know, then he just looks crazy.
What I was going to say is I think, even though I don't think Chappelle did this intentionally, the unintended effect of what he did may have been to put people on notice for the rest of the tour. You know, because immediately people were like, the next show, everybody was well behaved.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah, I heard that.
It might be a thing like he punched Hartford in the face. And now everybody's like, please don't punch us in the face, Dave. We just want to listen.
Yeah, right. They're like, we want to watch the show, sir. We'll be good.
Right.
Now, who are your comedians that you do? Because you kind of have like a ranking system, I would say. Like, you feel like Chappelle's a bit overrated.
I say that only because I thought before Chappelle's show, I thought he was considered, you know, a top tier comic, but not sort of a legendary comedian presence.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like the Chappelle show has been added to his, you know, for instance, if Chris Rock had to get his movies added on to his stand-up career, he would be ranked a lot lower as a stand-up comedian.
Yeah, I definitely add him too. Like, I count that, but then I move it up because the Chris Rock show was great. So,
well, that's, well, yeah, but I'm saying as a stand-up.
I'm just joking, man. I'm just joking.
Oh, okay. But as a stand-up, Chris Rock, like, to me, Bill Burr right now, for me, is the best working stand-up.
Right.
Like, I think, which is why I'm always confused why Louis C.K. has the title. And people can act like there's no title, but there's a title.
Yeah, for sure.
And Louis C.K. kind of has the, you know, Kevin Hart's the biggest moneymaker, and Louis C.K. is, like, the biggest critical darling.
I think it's also because no one can separate necessarily the other stuff he does. And there is a huge amount of respect for his autonomy where he's created his own kind of cash flow and creative system where he can do kind of what he wants. I mean, obviously at the end of the day, you have to report this, you know, FX or something at some level, but you know, his pay as you go, like I think a lot of comedians and industry people really respect that, and that leaks over into their liking their stuff.
I think, and I'm of the opinion that I can respect it and laugh at some of his jokes without sort of thinking that what he's doing is, you know, and I don't even care if big time comics say Louis C.K. is amazing. I go, there's only a few comics. I think we discussed this on Facebook, but like, you know, Chris Rock, Bill Burr, of the living people are probably the only two guys that I can think of that I would pay top dollar for without blinking.
Yeah, I don't. That's the thing too. I don't think Louis C.K.'s stand up is that amazing either. But it is one of those things that nobody ever says. So, but yeah, I don't find it to be that mind blowing. Even though I do, it's funny and it's solid, as Josh Homer would say. But I don't think that it's like, I don't remember his bits, and it doesn't become part of like cultural lexicon or anything like that. It's just kind of like, oh, and then next year he'll do another one. So I don't know. But I will say this about Chappelle though. I don't think I count as a majority of his fans, but I was a big fan of that dude before, even the Chappelle Show and stuff. Like I went to see him in Raleigh. It was after Half Baked, but probably like a year before Chappelle Show started. And I thought he was so great, right? And the audience was cool. Even though they did some like Half Baked quotes and stuff, it was like he played with the audience, because it was like, you guys know Half Baked? Y'all know that movie? And everybody's like, yeah, you know, all that shit. But it wasn't crazy. It was a theater. It wasn't a stadium. I've seen him afterwards. I've seen him in Clemson in a stadium. After Chappelle Show season one, and it was such a different experience. It was still good, but the audience was too fucking crazy, and they kept throwing them off, and it made me think I don't necessarily know that Burr, Louis C.K., even Chris Rock necessarily, I don't know that they could handle it necessarily better. They just have never done anything as quotable and cultural as a Chappelle Show, like that. So they're not gonna ever be tested that way. Cause what are you gonna quote? Poet in my hand for a dime? Like that, nobody's gonna do that to Chris Rock to ad nauseum, you know, with these entitled ass, like frat boy type dudes. So I think he just fucked up and appealed to the wrong fan base and got too famous. And it's just a shame, because I think he was I think he is a great comedian, but it's like a great comedian trying to fucking fight, like a boxer trying to fight on the road in the other dude's hometown. And, you know, like, it's just like, fuck, dude, you're fighting a losing battle against these crowds. But, you know, I guess that's not a bad problem to have if you're making all that money, but still. But yeah, man, that was kind of the main things I wanted to talk to you about. And I appreciate you coming on. The name of the new album or CD is Keep Your Enemies Closer.
Keep My Enemies Closer.
Okay.
It'll be, you know, check iTunes, check Amazon, because I'm only doing a digital release. I just use the hard copies for like promotional or for a couple live shows. So it'll be available iTunes, Amazon. It may be available as soon as like a week from now. Okay. But the date was supposed to be September 24th. But, you know, when you're a master of the internet, you fuck up pre-sale and all that stuff. And then you just say, okay, just get it up whenever you can get it up. And I'll just announce it then.
So do you mostly perform
I'll claim that people are bootlegging it and I had to upload it quicker.
Right, exactly. That's kind of the Kanye approach to it. Now, do you mostly perform in the New York area, or, you know, you do any, you travel at all? Anything people can look out for?
Yeah, I mean, I got some shows coming up in the city over the next week and a half, and then I'm in St. Paul, Minnesota, headlining the Joke Joint from the 19th to the 21st. So that's what I've got coming up.
Cool, man. Well, hopefully people check that out, man. If you do see or check out JL, also follow JL on Facebook. He is one of the more interesting people I follow on Facebook, and I'm sincerely, man, like, you're always putting out, like, even if it's a joke, it's normally like a thoughtful post, even when I disagree, or if I like am like rolling my eyes like, I cannot believe this motherfucker thought this much about Miley Cyrus. I'm always like intrigued to see like what kind of conversation you generate on Facebook. I think if people put in JL Coven and it'll be on in the show notes, guys. Go check that shit out, man, because it is worth the follow alone just to go, man, I can't believe he just said that. So
I can click the fan page, but I accept, you know, I accept friend requests. So you'll, the fan page is really just content, you know, like podcasts, movie reviews, blogs, but then all my extra commentary that you're talking about is on my regular page, which people are free to send me friend requests.
Yeah, dude, you should, if you're listening to this, you hear the sound of my voice, you should fucking do that. You might see me over there occasionally. It is always, I get notifications for JL. So you guys should, that's the highest compliment I can give anybody.
Well, thank you.
No problem, man. Thank you so much for doing the show. Make sure you guys check out jlcovan.com, Righteous Prick, the podcast. Like I said, a friend of the show, Chris Lambert is on there. Josh Homer from After Black, is on there. You know, and it's just a good show, man. And especially it's refreshing if you like stand up and comedians and you want to hear somebody that doesn't pull any punches or isn't just saying bullshit to pass the time until they're discovered by Louis C.K. and put on a show. all right. Well, until next time, thank you guys for tuning in to Medium Talk on the Blackout Tips Premium Network. We will talk to you guys again soon. Peace.